I'm very pleased this evening to welcome Graham Highgate from Sustain. Graham is a consultant whose company specialises in the business side of coping with climate change and the implications thereof. And he's going to be talking about that in his contribution this evening. And Stephen Aranjan, whom many of you will know as our host very often here from Steria, Programme Director looking after Steria's response to climate change issues. Although perhaps in this sense response is the wrong word, because he's very much at the forefront of driving things forward, so it's not a reaction, it's more an action. And I, Stephen Brown, my company produces an online version of the environmental management system, which is one of the ways that you, one of the approaches you can take to dealing with the problems of managing your environmental impact. And I'll talk a little bit about that as we go through. So to kick off, I'd like to invite Stephen to give us some context.
Good evening once again. As Stephen said, my name is Sivan Niranjan. I lead the environmental sustainability program for Group Steria, and we are based in 16 countries, 19,000 employees. We embarked on this exercise about a year ago. What I first want to do is to walk you through to set the context of climate change, because you really cannot miss these days, whether you open a newspaper, television, I think it's 49 days to go to Copenhagen. What is it? Yeah. So we can't miss it. So just to make this discussion more interesting, I just want to set a scene. If it's controversial, then I expect people to challenge me, and we will all go on a journey. I'm going to cover climate change, the challenge we face. Then Graham will talk about impact that has on businesses. And then Stephen would talk about the kind of systems and software and services that you can have to curtail it. Turning the clock back to many, many years, and I understand that the emission level and greenhouse gases have been now being measured by scientists for over 50 years. In fact, the first set of real tangible results were captured in 1958. And what has happened is that the man-made challenges have become more and more severe, to the fact that whilst the temperature over the last 100 years has been around, increased around 0.75 degrees, if we continue this way, virtually the majority of the scientists say the temperature is likely to reach at minimum 2 degrees through to as much as 6.4 degrees Celsius. And it may not sound severe, but if you look at some of the challenges we will face in terms of sea level rising, and you would have seen pictures of mock-up pictures of the central London underwater, and lots of other situations. Maybe certain parts of the world may improve, but what is likely to happen is there would be droughts and lots of challenges, starvation, which means that even the most developed countries will suffer as a result of mass migration of people. So we need to do something about it. And what we look at is, as I said to you, there's been a meteoric rise in the carbon level. If you look at it since the last 50-odd years, the carbon CO2 equivalent has risen from about 300, and it stands around 385 today. And if left unchecked, it's going to reach about 1,000 particles per million, and it just simply would be unsustainable. So what we have to do is to make sure that, putting some context to it, that's in today's term, 50 billion tons of carbon is being released into the atmosphere, which is impossible to sustain. And what's happening is that we are going to have a lot of challenges in every part of the country. To put some context to it, I mentioned about going from 2 degrees to 6.5 degrees Celsius. If you look at it, at 2 degrees level, there will be some issues. I know that when we drafted the program, we said perhaps parts of Europe, and perhaps, I think Stephen commented on, perhaps English wines might be better because our climate may be a little bit better. But joking apart, there will be lots of other challenges that we are going to face. And if you look at the other end, it's almost looks like a global catastrophe. We need to do, and the scientists met in Copenhagen in earlier this year, and as you know, that the bigger, the political politicians and the governments are meeting in end of December. We need to make sure that we need to cut the emission from 50 billion to 20 billion if we are to restrict the temperature rise to 2 degrees. It is scary. It really is scary. Just to put some context, when somebody chucks 50 billion and 20 billion, it just doesn't make to me as an individual what does this really mean. Let me share with you an example. Today, our world has about 7 billion people, I understand. We are emitting 50 billion, so it doesn't take a great... What's that? It's about 7 tons per person of carbon per year being emitted across the world on average. But of course, you would see that some people, perhaps across the pond, utilize and emit a lot more carbon than, for example, in Africa. So if we are emitting 7 tons of carbon per individual, with the forecasted population growth of close to 10 billion in by 2050, and by the way, the population is growing, used to grow, it went from 1 billion to 2 billion in 130 years. Today, every 10 years, every 9 to 10 years, the population is growing by 1 billion, just to give some context. 1800s had 1 billion, 1930 had 2 billion. 10 years ago, we were around 6 billion, and now we are saying that it's actually going to be about 9 to 10 billion. So utilizing and emitting 7 tons of carbon for individual at 10 million, we need to limit our exposure and the emission level to 2 million. What does that really mean? So if each one of us got a meter slapped on us, a smart meter, which I'm sure all of us are going to have in the very near future in our households, if we had a meter and if we were limited, a cap was put on us for 2 tons, per day, our allowance is going to be 5.5 kg. What does that mean? You can have a 25-mile car journey, or you can have 2 meals a day. Some of us do only have 2 meals a day today, but if that's the only thing you can do that day. So we have to change the way we live and operate across the piece. I think yesterday or day before, Gordon Brown said we need a step change. I think the entire world needs a step change to make sure that we are in a position to do something in order to ensure that we peg the temperature rise to 2 degrees. How do we do that? A bit of background. Kyoto was signed in 1997. Only about 20 to 25 countries actively participated, even though 180-odd countries took part. Notable exceptions were countries like the United States. The fast-developing countries like China and India were not party to it. Comes to an end in 2012, even for the group of countries who have agreed on a cut in the region of 5 and 8% by 2012. UK, we may have lots of other difficulties and challenges, was the first country to announce that it will cut its carbon emission by 80% by 2050, soon to be followed by the G8, which happened, the meeting happened in Italy, actually agreed that we will cut carbon emission by 80%. And there is also a push on countries like China, India, Brazil, and some of the other developing nations to reduce the increase in their emission. Because really the challenge is, at one end, one party says we need to save the planet, so we all need to reduce our carbon emission. To be fair, quite a lot of the developing countries would say it's very well for you to have got your industrialized and got your nations ready, and now to say that we all need to cut, it's not necessarily possible for those countries. So what is likely to happen in Copenhagen in another 2 months' time is that the great expectation is that all of the industrialized nations would agree to a cut of 80% following the G8, with countries like China, India, and the others following suit by saying, China has already made indications that its carbon CO2 equivalent will peak by 2020, and they will then start reducing it. But they need to get an agreement, a consensus, so that we can all move forward. The chances are that the industrialized developed nations will need to fund to assist the developing nations to bring in newer technologies, to change the way some of the culturally things happen in those countries. So therefore, today, they're saying something in the order of $100 billion would need to be spent per year from the developed nations into the developing nations. The Stern report, I think about 2 years ago, suggested that if we do not check this and if we do not begin to reduce the emission level, it could have as much impact of 20% of GDP of the entire world. But looking at the $100 billion US dollar investment, that amounts to less than about 1%. So therefore, there is even financial sense for countries to help one another to make sure that we are all together, because there's no compartmentalization. Outsourcing our problem to China so that emission happens there, especially, doesn't work overall. So we need to work together collectively to come. So there's great expectations in Copenhagen. And I think this morning's news said that there was a concern that Barack Obama may not necessarily attend himself, and that's been retracted now to say, no, he is considering to attend. So what we are expecting is countries like the US, China, and India need to work with the EU countries. Like the Scandinavians have been quick off the mark. Of course, they have the advantage of hydro as well as wind power in order to help their cause, but have been always at the forefront, especially Norway, which has actually made a commitment to cut carbon by 40%. Whereas the UK talks about 30%, which is actually on the high side by 2030. Where can ICT fit in here? So let's look at how it can help us. So if you take the G8 and the UK, if you say 80% cut, Gordon Brown and his men can't do this on their own. They're going to focus on three parts: the public sector, departments, all of the government departments, the businesses, and we are not immune either. The push is going to come. In order for the UK government to cut emission by 80%, they're going to push things down to us. How is it likely to happen if you are a business? And Graham will delve deeper into this later. If you are a business practice, whether it's your client or your investor, is going to turn around and ask you, can you demonstrate that your organization is behaving in a manner which supports sustainability? Working as an employee at Steria and leading this part of the activity for it, constantly I am pulled in front of institutional investors to demonstrate what the company is thinking, its plans, to demonstrate. We work, for example, with several public sector departments, and we are asked in every single bid on not only how clean we are, but also how we can help the individual government departments to reduce their footprint. So it goes further. Our solutions, I was with in a forum with Nokia about a month ago, and whether it's a Nokia or an IKEA, whatever they provide, their customers are going to ask, can you demonstrate your life cycle analysis of your carbon footprint? I don't know whether you recently saw in the press, Walmart has said from summer 2010, every supplier to Walmart needs to produce their life cycle analysis of their carbon footprint of the product, otherwise they would not be a supplier to Walmart. And they got, by the way, they've got over 100,000 suppliers. They could implement this in the US first, and then no doubt in the UK, in Asda, it's actually going to roll out to everywhere. So you can see the gravity of the companies. Whether you are a believer in climate change or as I've got friends and colleagues who might say, this is a natural phenomenon, you stand up and wave your green flag, nothing's going to happen. But it's actually going to impact us, whether we like it or not. As a householder, we're going to be impacted when smart meters get rolled out. As a business, you're going to get impacted. And there's going to be so many regulatory things. As a business, for example, at Steria, we are going to subject to something called the Carbon Reduction Commitment, which comes in April 2010. So these are going to be the primary drivers to whether you run a business, small or big. Bringing the subject more narrower, our industry, and I'm assuming everyone here is related to the ICT profession, we do not produce that much of carbon, 2% in a global sense. But in the UK, we actually produce between 6 to 8%. On a worldwide basis, ICT delivers only 2% of the footprint. That's the same footprint as the airline aviation industry. But you can see how much challenge they're being pushed into, even though they're 2%. But the difference with the ICT is that it can play a large part providing its intellect to cut down the wider footprint. And there was a recent study done by Intellect, which is the trade body for ICT businesses in the UK, that as much as 15% of the wider footprint can be cut if, one, the ICT sector is able to clearly position its technology and its innovation into the businesses, and also if companies can transform the way they operate. And what I mean by this is the 2% is mainly, as you would realize, it's in getting our data centers to run better, much more efficiently. You would see adverts from all of our hardware vendors in terms of consolidation, virtualization. There was a report out today from OWM saying that something close to 4.7 million servers remain idle in the world, costing $25 billion a year. And apparently there's 12 million tons of carbon being emitted. So you can just imagine that it's not just the carbon, the cost of running these aspects. So all of the virtualization and things come in there. But leveraging the wider business, we can have enhancing technologies such as providing better energy management, monitoring, then of course enabling technology in order for us to use technology, like as I said, virtualization to cut down, then also transformed the way we work. I've been here over the last 6 or 7 years. We actively encourage our employees to be home-based and provide the technology and tools for individuals. If each of our employees came into the office, there would be actually 2 to a desk. So we are also participating to make sure. Of course, the cynic could turn around and say, if you move somebody to the house, they're burning their electricity in their house, but perhaps it cuts the carbon of somebody traveling. So we need to look at it much more holistically, but BT has claimed that they've cut down their footprint by 30% plus by allowing employees to use their technology, using much more video conferencing facilities. So I think it can really help, wouldn't go as far as solving, but prolonging and pushing things to the right aspects. Now what I want to do is to invite Graham just to talk more specifically on how it impacts businesses.
Yeah, thanks, Siva, for a very comprehensive introduction to the problem. As the slide says, I want to take a different perspective and talk about how this all looks to businesses. First, I just want to add one thing, if I may, to Siva's introduction, which is a statistic which just came back into my mind while Siva was talking. And it's from the UK Climate Impacts Programme, UKCIP. And for me, it's one of the most graphic facts or projections about potential climate change, which is that in the UK, by 2050, if given a middle scenario, so somewhere between your 2 degrees and 6 degrees, the very hot summer of 2003 will be an exceptionally cold summer. And that made me think, yikes, that's quite a change, actually. I don't know if you remember it, but August 2003, the rails were buckling and the trains wouldn't run. We were all saying, this is climate change. And then it was cool after that for a few years and we forgot about it. But imagine if that was a summer that was exceptionally cold. That one just struck home to me as a very graphic illustration of what only 4 degrees difference might do. And I only want to really make one point, and that is that from the point of view of businesses, this all looks a bit different. And it's very easy to focus on the fact that climate change is a problem and the fact that we ought to do something about it, and we all know that. But when people come in to run companies and to do their jobs in government, as with many personal issues, they're sort of obliged to park their personal feelings about what we should be doing at the door, in a sense, and be driven by whatever it is that's driving their business. So let's just take the private sector example. You're running a business, you're the management team of a business, for example, and you're considering what climate change and the associated issues mean for you as a business. It actually looks quite complicated. So I want to talk about mitigation and adaptation, and I want to talk about whether things cost money or whether they might make you money. And there's a sort of spectrum, there's a 2x2 matrix there, which I'll now illustrate. So to start with, mitigation and adaptation. These are much used phrases in the climate change world. Just to be clear about what they mean, mitigation means doing something to reduce one's carbon footprint. So if we're a supplier, it doesn't have to be an ICT supplier, but as Siva said, there's quite a lot of potential in the ICT industry. If we're a supplier into industry, or indeed if we're some sort of business leader within an industry or within a government department, some of the things we can do are about helping that company or that department to reduce its carbon footprint. And that sort of activity is driven by regulation. There were lots of examples in Siva's piece about government regulation, the carbon reduction commitment, Kyoto Protocol. And if you're running a big business these days, these things do matter, particularly the carbon reduction commitment, which has teeth. And if you don't comply, nothing happens this year, and then some nasty things start happening the year after that, and then it gets really serious after that. So the boards of big companies are having to think about that. And the other sorts of pressure, customer pressure. If you're a retailer, it's particularly important, obviously, what the mass customer market thinks. And also employees, I think particularly younger employees who've grown up with climate change as a background to their education, are asking in interviews, because I've heard them, what are you doing about climate change? And you need to be able to say something coherent, and you need to mean it. And the other sorts of pressure come from investors. And there's a fifth one. I can never remember all five, but obviously stakeholders in a business are interested in this stuff. The other one, which gets talked about less, and I think is quite interesting from a business point of view, is adaptation. And, of course, it means, as a company, I've rather provocatively called this exploit the opportunities, but it also includes mitigate the risks of climate change. So this is to Siva's point about it doesn't really matter whether you believe it or not. You know, the world is behaving as if climate change is going to happen, because it probably is. So there are things you can do to ride that wave, either defensive things to mitigate risk or opportunistic things to say, well, if this is going to happen, that's terribly unfortunate, but it is going to happen, so we're going to make sure we're the first to do whatever it is that can benefit us. And that's not an immoral position, it's just a realistic position. Because you might at the same time be doing mitigation, but the adaptation point is distinct. And I've said, as an example, choice editing. I don't know if that means anything to anyone. It didn't mean anything to me the first time I came across it, but this is a supermarket thing. If you're... Now, I don't carry a commission for any particular supermarket, but I'll use John Lewis as a sort of neutral example, because we've all heard of it, I expect. If you're John Lewis, you might want your customers to think of you as a retailer from whom they can buy, and by choosing John Lewis, you've somehow made sure that you're buying something that's environmentally okay. Let me give you an example. I think it's true of John Lewis, actually. They don't stock any high energy use fridges. They only stock the ABCD fridges, the ones that are better for the environment. So, and there was a lot of debate about it. I went to the British Retail Consortium conference a couple of years ago when this was a hot issue, and there was an awful lot of discussion of, well, you can't do that. You can't, you know, people need choice. You can't restrict the range of what you're selling. But supermarkets were realizing, well, supermarkets and retailers generally were realizing that it's not actually about some sort of Stalinist restriction of choice. It's actually about trying to enhance your brand by being seen to have pre-selected a range of goods which are climate friendly. So there's a business opportunity there, which is it's quite important, isn't it? Because these retailers in particular, anyone who deals with the mass market, is always trying to position themselves as in a desirable way. And that's one component of it. So look out for choice editing. If you want to buy a very energy inefficient fridge for some reason, you probably can't, because they're all at it. The other example that I've given here is supply chain diversification. And what I mean here is that if you buy food, I haven't only worked for supermarkets, but these are the two examples. If you buy food from all over the world, you have to recognise that some of those supply chains are already being disrupted, either by climate change or by the threat of climate change. If you offshore, to use that as a verb, apologies for that, if you get work done offshore, then you have to be mindful for the consequences of labour movement, which will result from changes in climate conditions and sea level. And you don't need to be looking ahead very much to pick up the possible impacts of people planning ahead for that. There's a UK one, just to bring it home, is that local education authorities are, as we speak, well, probably not at this time of night, but are currently thinking about whether they can in the future continue to let out schools as premises for training in the summer, because it's getting too hot. Maybe that's looking a bit far ahead, but it's a real factor in planning school buildings, that we will no longer be able to use them unless they're air conditioned, which schools normally aren't here. So apologies for spending a long time on that slide, but that sort of sets the scene. I just want to run through a very quick sequence of slides that will, I hope, just make this point clear. Adaptation is about adapting to market change. In this case, market change driven by global resource constraints. This is a slightly more general point, but basically by the inability of the planet to support what we are planning to do. Mitigation is about mitigating your business's impact on global resource depletion, or in this case, on greenhouse gas emissions. And what I've tried to do here is to introduce this idea, to make it two by two, to introduce the idea that some of these things, if you're a company, will have a positive impact on your P&L, so they're a good thing from a business point of view, and some of them will have a negative impact on your P&L. For example, there'll be a cost, so they're a bad thing from a business point of view. So this is real sort of CEO level stuff. It's all in nice two by two. Apologies to all CEOs present, but you know what I mean. It's It's down at the basic level. The adaptation stuff we split into risk and opportunity. So if it's doing something for your P&L, it's an opportunity. If it's costing you money, it's a risk. And likewise, the mitigation factors you can split into investments if they're going to be something that ultimately benefits you, and costs if you just have to pay for them. So just to break those out in a little bit more detail, the wording I'd use around opportunity is that you're repositioning your business to address new opportunities arising from market changes driven by either real or anticipated global warming, reducing the environmental impact of your operations in ways that generate a payback. So you can see, of course, these two are the attractive ones from a business point of view. The risk box is about managing the risks that global CO2 emissions pose to your business, and the cost one is simply about, well, from a management point of view, the challenge here is to minimise the cost of those mitigation measures which don't pay back. And I've just to make these a bit more real, I've just scribbled down some examples from real situations that I'm aware of, just to illustrate where these actually crop up. The mitigation ones are, I suppose, in a sense, more obvious. I mean, some good examples down here, already mentioned, Siva. Reducing the amount of energy used in your data centres is a nice IT example. Running them a bit hotter. Google have tried it. Apparently the computers still work. So there's a no-brainer, apparently. I'll probably live to regret saying that. Maybe the computers don't last so long. I don't know. But it is looking quite promising, the idea of running your data centres a little bit warmer. Because I think the received wisdom about data centres has been established during a period when both energy and processing power has been quite cheap. And therefore, you might as well run it cold. Why take the risk? And now we're starting to balance that a bit. And this one, a good example here that's in the news a bit, is retrofitting coal-fired power stations so that they're not so dirty, which is a very expensive business and is going to make electricity dearer. So it's in the red box. These ones, which are a bit more interesting from a business point of view, I think, a real example I've been involved in is that we know fuel's going to get more expensive, so we're going to find some savings to offset the fuel costs because we need to keep our costs flat. So a whole program at a media company that I did some work for was predicated on the fact that the fuel prices are going to go up, so we're having a savings program. And the example here, also actually a different media company, was taking a green editorial stance. Thought was an interesting one. You have to be a media company to be able to do that. But the example was, come on, let's not just be miserable. Let's sell more newspapers because we're seen as the guardians of green. Hint in the phrase there. So I wouldn't mention any client names. So just to finish off, I just wanted to briefly show you. I don't know whether this is going to work technologically. If it doesn't, I'll stop rapidly. But I just wanted to show you. Along the theme of what can ICT do about it. I'm cheating a bit here because when I say ICT, I really mean program management. I'm sure somebody here has done some program management because it's an IT sort of thing. I mean, the BCS has events on program management all the time. But program management's what I do, so bear with me. I just want to show you what benefits mapping, which certainly grew up in the IT world, I think, can do in this area, to help illustrate that there is some complexity in here. It's not all about, oh my God, we have to reduce CO2. There's actually a whole range of business drivers in here, and they get all mixed up, and one has to then, one can, with tools that we use and have taken from the IT world, one can help to separate them out and make it a bit easier for business leaders to work out which projects they need to run in order to meet them. And this is a real example which I've been forced to anonymise, but it doesn't lose that much by being anonymised. And I just want to point out, really, the boxes at the top, I've made it big so you can read it, but the compromise, the sacrifices, can't see it all at once. This company wanted to, A, attract investors, B, demonstrate that it was going to be at the forefront of its industry, C, excite audiences, and D, motivate employees. None of which are very touchy-feely, green-sounding things, really. They're all kind of mainstream business objectives. And it's those four outcomes which drove their greening program. Sorry, where it says deleted, I just had to take out things that were made it too obvious who they were. But if you work your way back through, in for those of you that know benefits mapping, in the sort of traditional way, via intermediate benefits to the projects themselves and their outputs, you get back to the familiar projects to do with carbon footprinting, switching to renewable sources of energy, reducing carbon footprint, understanding carbon footprint, both direct and indirect, and some slightly spicier ones over here to do with communications, engaging business partners. So the only point I'm trying to make with that, and I won't dwell on it any further, is that when you take a business view of these issues, you end up with a load of stuff that actually looks rather familiar. And if you start joining the dots, it becomes a problem that's soluble by ordinary business logic. So I won't say any more. In summary, this subject is starting to be absorbed into business, and I'm seeing it all the time. And the contribution, I think, that certainly one contribution that we can make as a profession is to bring the logical and ordered approach to problem solving that we try to do with benefits mapping to bear. One of the things you need to do is measure your carbon footprint, because as several of Siva's examples showed, if you don't measure it, then you've no idea how much carbon you're releasing. So the energy, the measurement technologies are crucial to all this. And that's what Stephen's going to tell us about. So I will hand over now to Stephen.
So, I think we've got an energy problem. We've got an emissions problem, but that's not a very polite thing to say. So I'd say we've got an energy problem. Probably lots of other problems too. So taking it a stage closer to home, what can ICT do about it? How can we exploit the opportunity that we've got, being a 2% contributing industry, with the opportunity to affect 15%, if I recall what Siva was saying? We can improve the efficiency of our hardware and our software and our services, and we can enable our people to do something about it. So we've got the 2% we can address, that's our bit. We've got the 15% that we can help other people address. And in the background, we've got to think about how we do it. We can't just do it. There is a resources implication. I thought we'd start this little bit at, if you like, the beginning, where we as members of businesses or charities or organizations of some sort, government departments, have got an opportunity to understand that we can do something ourselves, or our departments can do something. There is a government target to reduce the UK's carbon dioxide equivalent production by 10% by 2010, 20% by 2020, 80% by 2050. So we do have a problem. We have a problem next year to get down by 10%. Let's have a look at what that might mean. If we can't measure it, we certainly can't manage it. And if we don't tell people, they can't change. This is an example I extracted from one of our clients. What you need to know is that this is their electricity consumption over a week. There's your working week, a couple of days before, weekend, a couple of days afterwards. This is an organization of, say, 1,200 people. They are conscious of their energy use. They are trying to do something about it. You might like to ask if they've done enough about it, because this was taken just last week. Peak load is pretty consistent. So what do we know about that? Well, we know that it was higher that week than it was this week, and it's going back up there. And we say to ourselves, what does that mean? Does it mean that it was darker, for example? Was it a week of cloudy weather? More lights were on. Well, if they're going to relate cause and effect, they really need to make some measurements. temperature would be a good start. Insulation, perhaps. It can be done. It's not difficult to do. But you need to do these sorts of things to understand where to start making adjustments. Most terrifying thing is this, I think. If that's 15 and that's 75, 20% of their peak load is base load. Something is consuming a hell of a lot of power all night and at the weekends and on holidays. Maybe they can't do anything about that. It may be that they've done everything they can do. They've got security lights, they've got fridges, something has to be thought about. We can learn something else from this. This little circle, hope you can see. Over one night, power consumption was much, well, a bit greater than usual. You can see that it's pretty much constant. They didn't do anything about it. They didn't know it was happening, I would suggest. Now, let's say that had been a long holiday. Something had been going on that was unmonitored, unmanaged, could have been for weeks. Well, they shut down for long periods. It's in their holiday patterns. This is where ICT can help. It's not difficult to set up monitoring. It will come through smart metering eventually. You can get it done now. There are various companies to do it apart from ourselves. You can set up automated alerts so that you know that something is amiss. All the goodwill in the world ain't going to solve the problem if you don't actually measure it. They get this information in this particular place every so many months from their power supplier. They get a half-hour record. These are half-hour records. But by then, it's far, far too late. They can't do anything about it unless they actually think about how to manage it. They've got a pretty consistent peak pattern, but they could look at the records that go down much more frequently than half an hour and start to think about what gives rise to that peak pattern. There's this interesting glitch here. Something happens. You can tell the people who work in that building something happens and bring it home to them that they make these things happen. They don't happen just randomly. And once people know, they can start to change their behaviours. It might be turning off lights, it might be turning off computers. A lot happens that can be changed, if you know. So that's an appeal, really, to say we can even begin very simply. How are we going to get that down by 80%? If the use comes down by 80%, well, that ain't going to be enough. 80% of the total load is somewhere in here. There's a big challenge here. But now we know what the challenge is. That sort of information can be fed into a buildings management system. Buildings management systems, which you may or may not know, are used to control heating and ventilation. Some of them, as we heard at a recent branch meeting, use IP-enabled controllers, which apart from being insecure in many cases and can be broken into and provide an interesting way of getting into the buildings, the businesses, IT, mean that the information that's in them can be disseminated relatively easily because there are browser interfaces to them. The stuff we do is on a browser interface because it's got to be communicated. It's accessible to everybody. The bigger picture from business, from buildings management systems are environmental management systems. That's where you have the opportunity to manage your impacts as a whole, whatever scale you feel appropriate and proportionate to your business. That's when you get into things like communicating with your employees and with your stakeholders on a much better scale. There are standards that you can apply. So going back to the Siva's points about government wants, if you want to work for government, clients want, stakeholders want. You can do visible activities that are managed and give you the badge to say, we're doing something about it. Not necessarily all IT. A lot of it's not IT, as we'll see in a minute. ISO 14001 is the international standard for environmental management. British standard A555 is a way of getting to ISO 14001 if you can't do the whole thing at once. It's a stepwise process that gets a tick in the box to say we're getting there. EMAS is a European standard that goes beyond 14001 in terms of what it demands of you and your communications with your stakeholders. The key to these standards are that they're not tick boxes, purely and simple. You must, to maintain them and retain the accreditation, show continual improvement. And that's why ISO 9000, which many of you will know about, has been rewritten in the manner of 14001 to require it to be actively managed in a business. Now, I've termed these incentives, Siva had them down as regulations. They're all different things to different people. There are things like business in the community annually give out an award to recognise those companies, those organisations which are really doing something about their impacts. Their impacts may be in the environmental field, in the field of social responsibility, etc., etc., etc. There's Eco Schools is a very good program for schools. And if you go around the country, you'll see the large green flags flying in places. That's getting it into the psyche of the kids early on. And it can be very successful, as well as supporting your local schools if they're doing that sort of thing. And then there are sector schemes. The construction industry has got schemes for managing its environmental impacts, its consumption. You know, you all have seen skips in the street. Well, some skips are taken off and recycled better than others. There's a lot of energy going into that sort of thing. I thought I would demonstrate the practical side of an environmental management system. This is just one example. Other flavors are available from other companies, but this happens to be ours. And as Graham has done, I have anonymized ours. This is an example from a real-life customer. So, what's involved in managing your environment? It's complicated, undoubtedly. It's not a simple option to go away and say, I'm going to get 14,001, or I'm going to look after these things. There's a hell of a lot involved. You've got to understand the context in which you're working. And to get 14,001, you've got to demonstrate to the assessors that you know what your company does and how it impacts on the environment. You break down the general context into what are technically known as aspects, objectives and targets. What we know about aspects, objectives and targets, it's management by objectives. It's something that many companies do explicitly and lots of do implicitly. Your strategy, your whole business strategy, as Graham was saying, needs to be bound up in these things. There's no point in doing one thing and saying another, because at the end of the day, you'll find that the assessor will come along and say, well, it doesn't make sense, it doesn't work. There are lots of what I've called other perspectives. Within the context of an environmental management system, within the context of proclaiming to your employees what you're doing, what you expect of them, and how they're achieving what they're doing through their IT systems, you've got environmental sustainability, you can do health and safety, all these other things. There tends to be a holistic approach in a well-run company. And last but not least is communication. You've got to tell people what you need to do and what they're achieving. You can use this sort of approach, for example, in a multi-site environment where you can set up objectives and targets for the sites, for departments, and they scale up nicely. You can run them with a big database sitting behind so that everything's self-consistent, everything is reported, and you can engender competition. And one trick that we like to demonstrate is you can demonstrate best practice. You can pull out from all the different places how each of them does it best. And again, to go back to a point that was made before, using sort of internet-based system, you can bring in your suppliers and your customers. You can get them to contribute to your footprint which you're trying to build up. You may have heard that David Mackay, who's become the carbon czar or something recently, said that, well, really the UK's impact is not X, it's twice X because of all the supplier contributions from China and so forth. So you can do that using your IT systems to have them tell you what your overall impact is by contributing. You know, imagine Walmart with 100,000 suppliers. I don't think they're going to be all doing it on spreadsheets. At least, I rather hope they're not all going to do it in spreadsheets, because it's going to be hell. As they're going through, we can do things in the IT industry. We can reduce the demand for energy and natural resources by running data centers hotter, certainly. That sometimes needs different chips that will run in hotter environments, and those chips are coming through. Data centers consume most of the 2%, according to some authorities. So it's not just the fact that many modems are left on all night and 5% of BT's electricity bill is servicing modems that aren't actually being used. It's these big data centres, and in the BCS there is a data centre specialist group who's working very hard on this. We can look at more efficient code, fewer clock cycles. I wouldn't like anybody to look at my code, but at least I know I can do something to improve it. It has certainly got room built in for improvement. Virtualization has been talked about, and that's the solution, as we heard last year from a couple of speakers, to some sorts of problems. Thin clients are solutions to some sorts of problems. I had a very interesting talk last Thursday from a guy from the data centres specialist group at BCS, who'd done a study to see, did it make any difference? And they found that under certain configurations, thin clients were really bad news, because the infrastructure of the servers and the networks required to support them consume far more than all the individual machines did. So it's horses for courses. And it requires much more technology and much more analysis than the obvious in order to make IT's impact reduce the way that it needs to go. Graham mentioned to me an interesting example the other day. When it comes to services, apart from putting things online and data centers and so forth, think about minimum configuration impacts in big systems, like ERP systems. They can be doing more or they can be doing less. You don't necessarily have to have everything reporting everything all the time. You can have those servers just doing less or turned off. And a big one, which we'll all have come across, or many of us will come across, is getting congruent targets. There's no point in getting some specialist organization to do your IT for you if what they're doing doesn't meet your particular aspirations in terms of carbon reduction. You can't outsource your problem unless you manage that outsource problem. Many people discovered 20 years ago that outsourcing doesn't work if you don't tell the outsourcer what it is you actually wanted them to do. You know, we've been there, we've done that, we know it doesn't work. And you've got to communicate that, as we've said, to your suppliers, to your customers, your colleagues. But resource depletion is a key. We can't just go out and buy new servers indefinitely. Okay, they may consume less of energy, but unfortunately they consume an awful lot of rare materials, which are in themselves severely limited. The dumping of the waste products causes environmental degradation. That's an IT responsibility too. Now, there are a lot of programs going through to address these things, and the government in this country, particularly through DEFRA, is making significant strides. They are a big consumer, and they are therefore putting a lot of pressure on industry to address these issues. Even, they say, on Microsoft, to avoid abandoning, say, XP after so many years, because that's something that leads to machines being thrown away. When the software support runs out, even though the machines are perfectly good and they're doing what you've been doing for the last X years, people throw things away because of support implications. So that's being looked at. And that brings us to life cycle management. And the government's quite, DEFRA are very active on this as well. Looking at the whole gamut from procurement to delivery to use and disposal. And then we've got all those interesting questions about should you send it to Africa or not? And if you send it to Africa, should you bring it back to dispose of it? Or should you create an infrastructure there to dispose of it? Because there's transport implications and so on and so on and so on. So it's a big challenge that's facing our industry. PAS is the publicly available specification. 2050, it's a method for measuring the embodied greenhouse gases. It's probably going to become a British standard in the next couple of years. It was put forward to be part of the ISO 14067, but it won't be. That was rejected last year. But something similar will become an international standard in the fullness of time. So, I thought you might be interested in what the BCS is doing about it, since the BCS meeting. Well, we've used these, or Steve's used these two little icons to indicate the 2% and the 15%. And BCS has got those behind a lot of what it's doing. Getting its own house in order, or our own house in the industry in order, and enabling others to reduce their emissions. BCS is very actively involved in influencing legislation and standards development in this country. The wee regulations you'll know about, if you came here, what was it, 5 years ago? Come on, you all came here 5 years ago, didn't you? You heard that bit. Emissions trading, you will know something about, that it's a cap. The carbon reduction commitment says that all organizations with a consumption of greater than 6,000 megawatts a year must pay to buy permits to produce that pollution, or they can sell it if they manage to get underneath their allocations. Of course, the allocation is a whole different business, but essentially, as Graham was saying, that's something with teeth. You're going to have to pay, and pay a lot. £12 a tonne is a number I've heard. There is a European code of conduct for data centres, and the BCS is extremely active in that through the data centre specialist group, and Liam Newcombe in particular. They have developed a simulation tool to look at how to run a data centre more or less efficiently, and that's going to be published in the coming months. If you're a member of the data centre specialist group, you can find out a lot more about that now, because it's being circulated within that group. BCS wishes to be recognized as a purveyor of best practices. You should be able to go to the BCS and ask, how can we do these things? And some of the specialist groups, not least perhaps the Green IT specialist group, should be able to help you with active steps that you can take. There is the foundation certificate in Green IT strategy, which, from what I've seen of it, looks like it's going to be worthwhile. It's going to have things in there that will help you to get your business to a less carbon-intensive future. BCS does provide a forum for debate, and recently there's been quite a lot about this business of whether we should be exporting old hardware to countries that don't have an infrastructure for dealing with it when it becomes redundant. I think that's where I'd like to stop. We will be happy to take questions. I'm aware that this has ranged quite widely from all sorts of different perspectives, and that perhaps is what we set out to achieve. There is no single answer. There's a multitude of answers and a multitude of questions. And we have our first question at the front here.
Basically, we go back to the first part of the thing on the model that we're talking about. Now, I've had a little work as a scientist connected with global warming and such like some time ago. And I think the big problem is, first of all, the uncertainty in the model. And the model does not allow for political and social problems, which could, I suspect, I mean, by 2050, I would suspect there might well be a billion climate refugees looking for new homes. That doesn't cover the impact of that, which could well be war, to be perfectly honest. But my own experience was in 1990, and I was invited to Australia. Now, Australia is one of the countries that's been worst hit so far of large companies, because they weren't expecting it. I was actually invited out in Australia to help build a system to keep politicians involved with climate change. And for political reasons, it was closed down before we finished it. And I think there's a real problem that we've got 181 countries who are involved with Kyoto. I can't see the politics of a large number of countries being able to take their populations with them. And I think there are going to be major problems. I mean, the legislation and such like is fine for countries like ours if the rest of the world remains stable. But we've got to be really we've got to have some contingency, I think, and not just think about this, but to think about what the other impacts could be. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I do. And the expectation, there's going to be 192 countries participating in Copenhagen in December. And what is likely to happen, again, one could say it's crystal ball gazing at this stage, the expectation is all of the industrialized or developed nations will implement a much more rigorous legislation, like what we are going to find, as Graham and Stephen mentioned, things like the carbon reduction commitment. In France, there's going to be a carbon tax, and all of those good things to force. And we will all have smart meters. In fact, in Australia, in Victoria, they've already implemented smart meters. So you could sit at your desk and look at the consumption and have options. So for the industrialized nations, there's going to be much more of a carrot and stick. What is likely to happen in countries which are fast developing, I think Gartner calls the BRIC nation, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, it's going to be something where a combination of incentives and financing, and that financing, I'm afraid, will have to come from the industrialized nations, but to make it happen. And there will be a third category where things like, I don't know whether you have heard about something called CDM or clean development mechanisms, whereby, for example, a country who's part of Kyoto at the moment can actually turn around, for example, like what my own company, Steria, does, used to be involved in initiatives in either India or Vietnam
places like that where they may be using in the rural areas kerosene lamp, kerosene cooking, where they are actually churning out a lot of carbon, to be able to implement formal mechanisms to get better, in this context, cooking facilities in order to reduce it. And there is a trading system which takes place, and there are formal organizations which audit these, so that you actually participate in what's called CDM, or joint initiative programs. But it's a challenge. I think I saw on the internet earlier today that they say Copenhagen will sort of work, but it's not going to come up with an agreement on, I think, on the 20th of December when they finish, or 18th of December when they finish. But what is likely to happen is it's going to spawn a series of discussions, which is then going to take place well into 2010. But it's a challenge, and I think your point of you can't build a wall around your own country. If things don't happen in other countries, you're going to have mass migration, and having border control is not going to work when things go. And there will be a tipping point. So I think it's in the interest of all of the developed nations to actually help to preserve and support those organizations. I don't think anyone has the answer.
I'm afraid I don't.
No. Yeah.
I was just going to say that, building on this point about difficulties beyond what you're describing, one of the problems that we have is that, in real terms, the reputation of politicians is, I suppose, frankly, in the gutter. And it's going to stay in the reputation will stay in the gutter, I think, for quite a long time. And politicians are going to have to be telling people in this country what it is that needs to be done. And people, frankly, aren't going to believe them. Mm. And I see that as a big stumbling block ahead.
Mm. Yeah.
Can I comment? I think that's a really important point. And the things like the carbon reduction commitment, and when you read the commitment to reduce emissions by 10%, 20%, 80% in those various years, you have to ask, don't you, what happens if we don't hit those numbers? Because so many targets have been missed over the last 5 or 10 years. Do you remember the e-government one? I mean, it's like history now, isn't it? But everything was going to be e-enabled, and it just didn't happen, and we all just thought, okay. So it makes you think, well, how real are these targets? Whether or not you think politicians' reputation are in the gutter, it's difficult to believe that you can really enforce these targets if we're not heading towards them. Which is one of the reasons that I, with business people, I like to focus on the opportunities, because it kind of drives them and gets them out of bed a bit more.
I'm very glad you brought up the question of population, because it seems to be something that many people have been very unwilling to admit to. I was at a meeting in the summer where people were showing a film that was all about impending doom, and at the end one of the audience said, well, what about the rise in population, won't that have an impact? And they said, no, the developing countries in which these population growths are occurring consume so little they won't make any difference. Well, they won't make any difference, except that there's an awful lot of them, and proportionally, and compared to, you know, America not reducing its 22 per person, it really isn't going to make a difference. But once those populations start to move, then there is a huge impact. And my sense is that it's only in the last month or two that people have been willing to contemplate talking about population as part of the problem. So I'm very cheered to hear that mentioned tonight.
I'm encouraged by what you said about population there, but I still have this great doubt that it requires such a level of joined up thinking that I have yet to see demonstrated from my local council, my local government, let alone internationally, I think we face a tremendous problem, even if it comes out as predicted and if we think we understand it. But from an IT perspective, are there any of the 80-20 benefits to be gained, do we see? Can we put in not 20% of the effort, but 20% of the potential solutions and gain an 80% benefit?
You're kind of asking which things should we do first, aren't you?
I
like your way of phrasing it, but it's the same question. Yeah. Can I start? I think the business case approach, where you rank things based on simple business criteria, works quite well. The on-site renewables is quite a nice one, because companies are starting to see it as a way, as something that pays back. So, putting a wind turbine in your car park, for example, is becoming less and less bizarre idea as time goes on. I don't know if, for anyone who's familiar with this area, the government is introducing, in the UK, is introducing feed-in tariffs from April 2010, which means that if you generate your own electricity, you'll get paid a significant amount of money instead of the paltry amount that you used to get. And I mean significant, in that the wholesale price of electricity is around about 6 pence per kilowatt hour for industrial users, and the feed-in tariff is 18p or 26p per kilowatt hour, depending on the size of the installation. So it's serious money, and that's a good example of how a bit of local, well, UK government policy has suddenly made something a priority. So that's one way to prioritise, certainly if you're a business.
I think fundamentally energy consumption. Energy is not the whole story, but energy, most organisations are looking to cut their energy, which also has a byproduct of saving money, like the Ovum report that I saw today. So, for example, quite a lot of organisations are looking to see how better they can, in our Indian company, we managed to cut our electricity in one of the centres in northern India by 20% by pure cultural education of saying, switch off things when you go home, don't leave monitors on aspect. Of course, we had also the one or two oddities where people got quite keen on it and they were switching things off that had to be left because they needed access. So you need to do it in a coordinated way. But we were able to cut 20% of our electricity bill in a center which has about over 1,000 people. So in a way, the low-hanging fruit was to actually get individuals to learn better. In this building, unfortunately, we don't have motion sensors. If any of you have been into an IBM building, you will notice that if you are sat in a meeting room, occasionally you have to wave your hands, otherwise the whole thing actually goes dark. Now here we are thinking of putting in simple things like that to ensure that the meeting rooms, so today we are actually getting individuals to photocopy. We implemented multifunction devices for as a default double-sided, which we are going to roll out from December. So little things actually soon add up. There was a survey I saw recently by Lexmark that said 11% of any organization printing is wasted. People don't even bother looking at it. Delayed printing. If you come into any office in the morning, you will see lots of printouts that people have sent to the printer either twice or forgotten to collect. So having delayed printing so that when you send it to the printer, you walk to the printer and press a button to get it out. So there are lots of little things that one can do to cut the energy and the carbon footprint. But then you get to the bigger challenges of things like getting... In fact, we are considering a wind turbine even in this location to see. So you can see how organisations are moving to consider it. So I think the low-hanging fruits are the energy aspects, which also gives the benefit in a recession of cutting cost. By the way, I also understand that due to the recession, there's some little good news that apparently the UK's carbon footprint is going to reduce by 3% because of the recession in 2009. Not sure whether...
Yeah. One thing which in some places could work quite effectively is managing your file storage. Margaret Ross, whom some of you may know from BCS, mentioned last week in a presentation that someone in one of the departments that she was concerned with had a bit of time on his hands at one point and thought he'd see about deleting some unused files. The department that he was with managed to reduce their file server numbers from 20 to 4. Not megabytes of storage, this is numbers of servers from 20 to 4 by, over the course of a few days, getting rid of all the stuff they no longer used. There is a serious problem with cheap storage. The days of yore, when you had to pay £1,000 a megabyte or $1,000 a megabyte, you looked after your storage very, very carefully, and people bickered about it all the time, and now they just buy more disks, and those disks consume a lot. So part of the low-hanging fruit is very often simple management along that nature.
Yeah, just building on that, I think one behavioural change which I'm seeing a bit is charging business units for their electricity, because it used to just be a kind of corporate expense that you didn't have to worry about. You didn't worry about the price of the disk, not the electricity bill, but I think more and more corporates are now charging this operation here for the electricity it uses, so it hits their P&L and they start caring about it. Only a small thing, only a simple change, but it's sort of aligning what we're trying to achieve with the personal drivers that people have in their business. Seems to work.
Don't wish to be contentious, but an organisation I know of used to do that for its computer services, and it paralysed them.
Right.
Because people were afraid to use that service because of the implications, and they didn't know how much everybody else was going to use over the charging period. And so what they had was a huge and very good IT department that was totally underutilised, and lots of services that people wouldn't use. So that's what I was thinking about in terms of congruent targets. You've got to make sure that the targets match, and so those things work very well in the right environment with the right culture. And again, it comes down to communicating with people, telling them what they're achieving and that they are achieving it, when they're achieving it and when they're not.
I think it's fairly safe to do it with electricity, because if people use less, you don't have an overstaffed department left doing nothing. But as with all these things, it has to be done with care.
The same argument applies, as was mentioned, with home working. If everybody worked at home and you closed the offices that they used to occupy, then it might work. If not enough people work at home, then you're running empty offices, and if you can't consolidate the office space, then you might just be paying as much in energy to maintain bits of those offices at the right temperature, and so on and so on and so on. So there's no simple answers. Home working can suit some people. It doesn't suit everybody. You have to be socially, I wouldn't say sociopath to work at home. I work at home. And look at me. But it doesn't suit everybody, and therefore you have to be careful to offer it to the people that can benefit from it and not force the people that can't benefit from it to do it. Hearing from a data center manager again last week at a BCS meeting, when he first started up his home-based call center business, he just took people from the business that he'd worked from before, and they all went to their homes and they all worked merrily, and within several months he'd lost about 20 or 30% of the staff, because it really didn't suit them to work at home. And there were others whom it really did suit, people who had got could manage their hours to suit themselves, to suit their family circumstances.
This whole business about where one works, there are costs. Now, when you're working out your business costs, do you include all the travel costs of all your staff? And if they're working at home, a part of their home costs? Because if you don't, you're outsourcing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't draw attention to it as we went through the image of the environmental management system, but one of the things you can do with a comprehensive environmental management system is integrate information not only from your customers and your suppliers, but also from your employees, say from the accounts expenses system that enables you to account for the carbon or whatever the energy used in, say, their travel to work, or their not travel to work, or their work at home. So yes, the system, we have the technology, if you like, but it certainly has to be done.
And just to add to it, some of you may have heard called the Carbon Disclosure Project, where most, like FTSE 350 companies in the UK, Fortune 500 and Europe 300 organizing it. There, unfortunately today, they do not ask what's called Scope 3, the business travel. They think it's far too complicated to ask home to office travel. So it's only business travel, because it's very difficult for organizations with the systems, because you don't claim expenses for traveling from home to your base location. So therefore, most of the organizations have said it's, we believe in it, but we can't give you the number. So most of the carbon footprint for companies, when they say my carbon footprint is X, that excludes home to normal place of work travel. However, travel between offices and travel to clients are captured easily, simply because there are systems which you have to claim your expenses. So for example, for Steria, the carbon footprint across the 16 countries is 32,000 tons. So that includes all our oil that you use for generators as backup, through to electricity, through to business travel. And other 40% of our, and we are typical in a service, in an IT services organization, over 40% is business travel, a carbon footprint. And the other 45%, another 40 to 45 is business travel, as you would expect. It's the energy and electricity and thing are the main thing. But today, most of when people give you a number, that unfortunately excludes home to.
Could affect where, very much where people live.
Yeah.
And that could affect things like the housing market. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of people that live in this area which commute quite a long way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's all sorts of other implications. People might cut out their business to work and travel to work in order to live, say, in the countryside, and they think, great, we've done away with all that commuting, but they might then have to do an awful lot of travel in order to go to the shops. Some of you may know that Buck's Primary Care Trust has recently changed its prescribing policy, so that regardless of medical requirements, GPs can no longer issue a prescription for more than 56 days. Apparently it's more convenient for the patients. What it means is that instead of getting a prescription for, say, a year and making one journey, you've now got to make at least 6 journeys. So one suspects that there's an absence of joined up thinking there. I think the answer is that they're looking for money, because you can charge people for prescription charges 6 or 12 times a year, which you, before, if you can only do it once or twice, that wasn't nearly as good for the PCT. But they haven't considered, I suspect, their bigger picture. So it's just not joined up thinking. I'm going to write to them and ask them. I discovered this yesterday. I'm going to write and see if they've thought about it, because it would be very interesting.
It's the same in Hertfordshire, and it particularly applies to the elderly who do not pay prescription charges.
So there we have it. A well thought through policy. Allegedly.
Some of those things are almost impossible to calculate, though, aren't they? Because who only goes to get their prescription and does nothing else. That's not how life is, is it? You go and get your prescription when you're going shopping. So the idea that you want to have 12 visits that you wouldn't have otherwise made, that's not true.
It might not be true.
You might have to make a visit to get a prescription to take to the chemist. And then you do double the travel.
I think the difficulty for most individuals, certainly me, is, and you know, the discussion about low-hanging fruit, 80-20, is it really isn't clear what are the things which would happen. You know, should I go home tonight and plough through my storage or my machine? I could spend 20 hours. Is that a good use of my time, or should I be doing something else? That sort of advice isn't really around yet.
It's very hard to quantify on a very small scale. There's an argument that says that people shouldn't be worrying about turning off their phone chargers, because although the cumulative proportion of energy going on phone chargers, it's quite a lot of energy, it's a couple of power stations, in terms of what has to be achieved, in terms of that 80%, it's nothing or very little. So the sort of things we've been talking about tonight are getting the 2% down that the IT industry contributes, and using the IT to bring down the 15% that we can influence. But that's nothing to the really big issue, which is how do we do something about transport, and how do we do something about domestic heating? Because those are the really big factors. If they're not addressed, then all the rest of it is just so much postponing of the inevitable. So that point that you've made is absolutely key to the whole discussion. What do I as an individual do that's worth doing? But knowing that something is better than nothing might be a good way to begin. If only because if everybody, all the 7 billion now and the 9 billion shortly, are aware of these things, then not only does the little make up a bit, but the action of a population or of populations is reflected to some extent in what their politicians feel able to do. And it's that permission to act from the politicians, that when they feel they've got that, that really does move the game forward.
Just have a very general question. Is there any kind of an impact study being done to assess, to understand the impact on the economic situation by the changes in the way we are going to, you know, we're planning to cut down on carbon emissions and all of that? Let's say we cut down on business travel, bring down. I'm not saying business travel is unnecessary. It is a necessary thing, although there are other ways of, you know, video conferencing and stuff like that. But business travel, cutting down on that, would result in lesser economic growth in certain sectors, for example, the airline industry or the transport industry. And that industry obviously employs a lot of people and resulting in unemployment in all forms. So how is that being handled, if at all it is being handled? This has an impact on business in general. On the one hand, yes, we want to save the environment, save the world for the future and all of that. Not for 1 minute saying we shouldn't be doing anything. But what is the impact, immediate, short-term, medium-term, longer-term impact? As one of the people pointed out earlier, it could be a situation where people might take up arms and then start fighting and get into a civil unrest thing. Because people are losing jobs because of all of these initiatives. Is there something that is being discussed? Yes, Copenhagen, the Kyoto Protocol, the G20 summit in Pittsburgh and whatever else, they talk of environment everywhere. Yes, it's important. But
to my knowledge, I think the answer is no at a government level. To my knowledge, no. I think there's a big gap between the sort of big socio-economic, what will happen in 50 years' time, big population movements, war breaking out. There is work done on that, but it's quite academic because it's still very difficult to be precise. Back at the tactical level, I think it's all about how. It's all about how do we reduce emissions. But the only work I'm aware of on trying to quantify the impacts of reducing carbon emissions on business is done by businesses, and it's a mitigation thing. It's saying, well, we can see this is going to happen, so we need to get out of airlines and start making fans for air conditioning systems as well. You know, that's that sort of business logic. I don't, I mean, Stevie, you know the regulatory field better than I do.
Let me give you two answers. Let me start with the positive one. Even if you look back 50, 60 years, industry has moved on, and we would have worked in the coal mines, etc., and that has petered out, that people have migrated to other things. So because it's not going to happen overnight, there's plenty of warning, and it will become much more uneconomic to work in those arenas. There will be a gradual migration of industries. Like 50 years ago, how many people would have worked in ICT in the UK? Today, I think it's close to a million and a bit, I'm told. So when the population is 60 million, directly involved in the ICT, 50 years ago, I would have think, percentage-wise, it would have been a fraction. So the expectation, positively, is that we will find other areas and businesses to migrate onto. The airline industry, you said, would become much, you know, they will use less, they will use better fuel, whatever that may be, and they will become more efficient, is the expectation. But the challenge is, as that gentleman said, every country works, although there may be protocols and legislations, but we all work independently. And if the bigger players don't act, and whether we like it or not, US for the next, at least the next decade or two, is still going to be an important player. So there's great expectations on the new president there, saying that he will actually lead from the front, and if the US takes some action, then that will trickle to, not necessarily Europe. Europe is ahead of the game, but the US influence has much bigger influence across the rest of the world and will follow, kind of thing. But I don't think it's coordinated. I don't think there is a blueprint for somebody to turn around and say. So there will be chaos. But the expectation is that people will find, business will find things which are more efficient. Like, for example, take Steria, for example. Our clients turn around and say, What is your commitment to cut carbon? What is your sustainable policy? These are being asked on every, whether if you run a chain of hotels, you're being asked. If you run, if you're Avis, you're being asked to say, what is your investment plan on it? You know, how do you move into buildings? So all of the companies will have to have some kind of a plan if they want to remain in business to make profit. So I think it will be a gradual shift.
Perhaps businesses have to look at reducing or the number of air conditioners they have, or ask people to make some small sacrifices to the comfort levels. You know, if 20 degrees is what most people want, hey, work at 22 degrees so that we, you know, cut down the energy requirements. I don't know, small sacrifices, they all add up. Mm.
But it's difficult to be the first. It's difficult to be the first business to do that, because your employees will all go and work at the more comfortable.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, it is difficult. Yeah.
In fact, one of the speakers at a future talk, future BCS presentation in Hearts, is to talk about biomass-driven data centers, because as you most likely, the biggest energy is for cooling in data centers. And although chip technology and all of those are improving, energy is consumed a lot for cooling the data centers. The first biomass-driven data center in Europe is going to be in Cambridge later next year. So we have invited the speaker to come and share with us the thinking. Something new, aspects of it. So those are the kind of things that organizations need to look at. When we were, for example, quiz by the analyst of what is it that you, because we run data centers, to turn around and say, what is your future? What are you investigating on your future? So things like turbines, investigating renewable energy, looking at biomass, cool data centers, aspects of. So having said that, then we need to investigate to make sure that we either rule them in or rule them out or look for an alternate. So it's going to be challenging times.
Can I just say it'll be 24th of February for all those who'd like an early alert to the date of that?
Okay, what impact do you think that the shift in taxation is going to have on the economic future of the country? Because obviously, where people stop using these carbon-driven products such as petrol, the government's revenue from taxation is going to dry up.
It's a bit like the impact on business question, isn't it? What are the consequences of the implied slowdown that would result from truly getting a handle on emissions?
You just pay tax on something else.
What do you think it'll be?
It'll be whatever you use instead of petrol. It'll be air.
there's a good point about taxation, though, which is to try to align taxes with things that we don't want to happen rather than align taxes with things that we do want to happen, in the sense that we currently tax income, which is basically a good thing. If you tax producing emissions or something that we don't want, fundamentally that's got to be better. But you then get into the whole social argument about whether you should be taxing people at source or when they spend, and it's complicated. But in principle, retaining our living environment becomes more and more of a factor, we're going to have to tax undesirable activities, not desirable activities.
I think we need to draw things to a close now, if we may. One more question? Mike's got a question.
We've been talking a lot about things like thin clients and about cooling data centers being an enormous burden. It strikes me, Justin, as two, we've missed something here. I would like your comments on whether it's significant. First off, in the last 20 years, computers have gone up in speed by a factor of about 1,000, in energy consumption straight off the power supply by a factor of at least 5, and we're still doing word processing. And I'm wondering whether we're ever going to get the developers of the technology to bear in mind that we're using top-heavy technologies in that case to do a very simple task. One of the savings could be to make darn things simpler again. Equally, on the same front, data center cooling, well, whether or not you run them at a higher temperature or not, eventually that heat's got to get out somewhere, otherwise it catches fire. So how much does the actual emission of energy as heat influence this position?
Can I just take the last point? I don't think at all in principle, except that you've had to obviously generate the energy that gives you the heat. But I don't think we're concerned about emission of heat. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah. Broadly, we talk about CO2 equivalent. There are about 6 different gases. And for example, some of the gases are much more dangerous to the atmosphere for us, for living, like methane and others. Some of them are about 22 times more dangerous than CO2, but the measurement unit is CO2 equivalent. So as I think I agree with what you're saying, the heat per se doesn't cause global warming assisting the climate change causing the climate change, but the 6 gases do impact because it actually traps it. The heat which comes, it gets trapped in, hence all of the problems environment. So I don't believe the heat being thrown out of the data center is going to have an adverse impact on climate change.
It's because of the persistence of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is the key point there.
So that raises my point. Is the cooling so incredibly inefficient then that it adds significantly to the burden of energy conversion?
Yeah.
It's simply that it's a very inefficient mechanism, is it, the cooling process? So why is it a problem if it isn't?
It's not the heat, it's the fact that you've got to produce the energy to run the coolers.
So you're consuming electricity.
Which produce carbon dioxide. It's the secondary product, if you like. It's not the primary heat that's the issue. It's the consequences of the cooling activity. And will there be word processors, as it used to be, that didn't do anything else? If the market is there, Apple will make a product for it, and everybody else will follow. And if there isn't a market for it, Apple may well make a market out of it, the way Sony did with the Walkman.
We've almost got the wind-up computer, haven't we? We've got the wind-up radio and various other things for intermediate technology.
And we sometimes get wind-up questions at these events. And on that note, if I may, I thank you very much for coming and bring it to a close.